I'm Speedy Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. I tell you, I think I'm getting a touch of senility. I was in this meeting this afternoon, and something was said and triggered me to remember that I left half my clothes in Smyrna, Georgia. And I was going to look real spiffy for you folks tonight and have a tie and all that on. And I had to go up and get me a coat off the plane pipe rack upstairs. If you ever need any clothes, just walk up those stairs. There's a nice rack. Just take your pick. This is not a button missing or two. We may have to go and have a senility anonymous. I was reading Psychology Today. Now, the only reason I was reading Psychology Today for my great mental capacity was that I had gotten it because I'm one of those suckers for that publisher's clearinghouse, you know. And I figure it's as cheap as any of them, so that's the only reason I got it. But I flipped this thing open the other day, and I was looking at it, and had an article, a new group, IA, Impotence Anonymous. And even have Al-Anon, you know. Imagine the poor guy getting there and says, "I'm Joe and I can't get it up." So, you know. I'm starting me a new group, though. It's going to be called LNA. That's like a Nookie Anonymous. And we're not going to have any Al-Anons. And this would be the only group in AA that's perfectly all right to have a slip. He was introducing me, and guy was talking about me one time. He says, when I first came to AA, because I seemed like I had a small amount of arrogance. You know, just about that much. And he says, "You're the only guy I know of that can check into the bridal suite and have a good time by yourself." I tell you, if these folks just knew how really sensitive I am, they wouldn't do all these things to me. But I'm one of those garden variety drunks that Jim used to talk about. And for some reason or other, unknown to me, for 6,000, I multiplied this out, see, I got all this. 6,540 days, one day at a time, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mind-affecting drug of any other kind. Because for some reason or the other, I was one of those fortunate ones that came to AA. And for one reason or the other, I just thought I'd try it out to see what it's like not drinking. I don't know why, as brilliant as I am, that it never occurred to me the way to get sober and stay sober was not to drink. Now, why couldn't we be? I don't know anyone in here that thought of it either. I couldn't imagine, you know, tapering off was all right. But to not drink, now that simplicity of that, not drinking, just never did seem to hit me. And I just thought I was going to try it. And I've just been trying it one day at a time ever since. For all of you that don't have your calculator with you, on July the 5th will be my 18th birthday. So that's how many days that is. If I make it that long. I know my birthday on the 5th. And our group that meets, my home group is in Jim City, Marietta, Georgia. Cobb County, we are the best. Now, they wouldn't even let me have my birthday on my about 10th birthday. They said, "Hell no, we're not going to ruin your day." I mean, that just showed these folks just. I was talking to some of them about this colorama. They said, "How do you get in this thing? Is it special? You know, by invitation? I mean, we'd kind of like to come." And I said, "Well, it's about like these couples wanted to join a Catholic church, three of them." And so they talk to the priest, and the priest says, "Well, you got to go without sex for 30 days. Well, yeah, we can do that. So 30 days later, the three couples show up, and the first couple said, "Well, how'd you do?" And they said, "We did all right, Father. No problem." So I asked the second couple, said, "Well, how'd you do?" They said, "Well, we almost lost it on about the 30th day, but we survived." Said, "How about you?" Talking to the third couple, said, "Well, we had a little problem." Said, "About the 27th day, my wife leaned over to pick up this head of lettuce and said, I just couldn't stand it, and we just, this happened." Said, "Well, you know, you can't come into the church." Says, "You know, they said that about me in Kroger's." So I told them we didn't have anything like that. You know, you didn't have to abstain from anything. If you just let us know, we feel like we can get you here. Anyway, I'm delighted to be here as usual. And I was in such a hurry to play such brilliant golf out there. And I forgot it. You know, you're supposed to get it in a hole. God, those greens out there were terrible. Anyway, I blame my mother for my alcoholism. I have to get around to that. That's what we're here for. I was born in North Carolina in Asheville, right across the mountain there. I only stayed at 3 years old, so I don't know a whole lot about it, needless to say. But she said that one time I had the croup, and so she gave me some corn liquor with a little sugar. And she said, not only did I get over that croup, said I smacked my lips for about a week. And I always did love that corn liquor. It's just something about drinking that corn liquor that it just, I mean, one thing I think the reason I enjoy it so much is the people I drank with couldn't stand it. And when you can find something these other bozos won't drink, you're in hog heaven. And I know I used to keep it under the sink like everybody else. I try to find out why most people keep that liquor under the sink. Corn liquor, then said, "Well, in case it blows up, it'll only take out the kitchen, you know." But you could always tell a real drinker. You know, I had guys coming to me and they knock on the door. "Speedy," it was one Sunday morning. "You know, you got a drink?" And I said, "Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah." Oh, man, you know, they come alive. Ooh, they knew they were in the right place. And I'd reach under that sink and get that half gallon, you know, and then their eyes, "Is that all you got?" You know, one of those guys. You could tell he wasn't a damn drinker. Shake that thing up and say, "Look at the bead on that." Then take the cap off. Then this was the true test to see if he was a drinker. He just shove it on his nose and say, "Smell that, boy, ain't that good?" And if he didn't throw up, he's probably a drinker. But I always try to keep some of that because that was reserved while I was looking for that liquor that I knew I had. I always knew I had some somewhere if I could ever find it. I used to write myself notes, you know. I'd sit there at the dining room table and these hieroglyphics. They probably look good on those damn walls back in the caveman days. And and the next day I couldn't tell what in the world I wrote, and I never did find the liquor. Most of the time I drank it. I know I did. And most of every alcoholic I ever talked to, they always said they spent all that time hunting for them. They just knew they had one. But that was a terrible time on Sunday looking for that liquor. But at any rate, my dear mother, having indoctrinated me on corn liquor, I stayed sober for the next 13 years. Hardly, but I did. But I got started just like most people back in those days did. The older guys seemed to have some fun. And I remember we chipped in 50 cents a piece. I was raised in Atlanta. And we bought one of the old T-Model Fords from the Ram and Wreck Parade. Georgia Tech, $2. And we take this old T-Model and get a half a pint of gin and ride around town in it. You know. Now, that was our fun time. I know we rode out Stone Mountain one time, had 14 blowouts. You know. And we had already patched the thing so many times, we finally just threw it away and started putting dirt and stuff inside the tires and put those old lock rings down. And they'd throw rocks and things. And finally got on the streetcar tracks on Ponston Lynn. Until the police got us. It seemed like, I don't care how old you are, once you start drinking that liquor, police seem to gravitate right to you for some reason or the other. And they said, if you don't get that damn automobile off this road, we'll put you boys under the jail, under it. And of course, we believed them back in those days. But anyway, this was a type of thing that we were doing. And so I didn't do a whole lot of real heavy drinking until I went to the service. And I went to the Air Corps to take pilot training. And right away, of course, I knew I had to get on my drinking, because from what I understood, and the way I ever heard this, but I knew that pilots are supposed to drink. I know I probably thought that up, you know. And I know the very first time I had off from this little training school I went to, I sat on the beach down in Miami Beach in this little old place right on the beach and just drank all day. And that's the way, that was my pattern from then on. I always knew when I had enough. When I couldn't get another drop in, and it ran right out of the corner of my mouth, I knew that's as much as I could have. And that's when I quit. I used to pride myself on drinking all that liquor. Needless to say, I had to pay the consequences of in the military, they want a little discipline, but they still need pilots. So I did, you know, usual little things like walking tours and details, any kind of detail for the baddies. There were always a group of baddies and cadets. And there was about four or five of us, and they singled us out, and it seemed like it followed us right on through. But I want you to know that every one of us baddies made it through. I know this old boy that I was in training with, and he's one of those good kind. We'd go in and spend all our money and get drunk, and then end up borrowing money from him. And so when we went overseas, the 5th Air Force, and he went to the 7th. And on his first mission, he got shot out. And I told the old boy, I went, I said, see there? That's what happens to those goody-goodies. See, you try to do the right thing, gets yourself killed. You know, that's facetiousness even then. But you look at it, one of the only probably Japanese aces in the American Air Corps, World War II. I had 5 hours, you know. They said, how about bringing this one back? So I did have a lot of trouble, because I'd be getting and doing things that I wasn't supposed to be doing, or be in places I wasn't supposed to be. I know I was in New Guinea then, and I piddling around over a place, and they already told me, don't go over there. And I said, you know how. Hell, I went right over there. Because we'd had some great alcohol the night before that we'd gotten from the Australians and put in a papaya, you know, and put a little plug in that papaya and pour it in there for 24 hours. I never could wait 24 hours, but it'd make it crazy as hell, I tell you. They had those beetle nuts. But at any rate, I know one time my squadron CO, he decided that he was going to take the liquor and hide it, because some of it had been disappearing. And he took it and put it in his tent. And he had him a little cooler. It was only two coolers on the whole island we were on. And I'd sit up there and look at him drinking that cold beer, and I could see that condensation on that beer. And we'd get six cans a week, you know, packed in sawdust, and it was hotter than 40 hell. We were almost on the equator. Anyway, and I'd sit there with that old hot beer and watch him. And somehow or another, his tent caught on fire. Burned his refrigerator, just melted it right down to the damn ground. And the liquor disappeared from his tent, and he never found it. He found a lot of drunks walking around. He couldn't even get up enough to fly a mission the next day, I don't think, because we drank all our liquor up. I know I was home 3 days after I hit good old Atlanta. Hero Moore gets picked up on the in front of old Paramount Theater, because it was running about 70 miles an hour down Peachtree. And the cop says, from what I understand, he said, I was told, he said, I used to have trouble with black eyes. I mean, once I started drinking, I mean, I go where the liquor went. As soon as I started drinking, wherever that liquor took me, that's where I went. If it took me unconscious, I went unconscious, you know. And if I went into black eyes, I went in black eyes. So he says, told me that I couldn't fly across the aisle. I said, I wasn't in a damn airplane. He said, I'm going to have to take you down to the jail. I said, you can't lock this hero up. But they put me on the third floor of that city jail, but did give me a semi-private room. Six months later, I was cruising on Peachtree Road, and some jackass left his car right in front of Brookwood Station about 2 o'clock in the morning and in my way. And I tapped him and went across the road and through the service station, made the first exit ramp, I-75 and 85, which wasn't even there then yet, you know. So here I go again, same cell. And you know what I did? I said, they'll never catch me again. I didn't say a damn word about not drinking anymore. I was 22 then, ripe old age, 22. I'd already had court martial and from doing some other little things. And, of course, if it's a good thing the war didn't last long because I'd have shot my CO down. I did try to do it one time. And he asked me, was I trying to shoot him down? I said, yes, sir, I was. And if he took that damn liquor, because there's something about somebody messing with alcoholic liquor supply that brings out hostility and resentment and anger. I mean, you can take anything else I have, but leave my liquor alone. You know, you can replace other things. And I felt like I couldn't replace that liquor. And so I got out and paid a small fine on the second time. And from that moment on, that was in 1947. From 1947 to 1966, I never got caught again because I knew every back road. Because I'd been stopped out of the God knows how many times. He came out with a thing called a breathalyzer. And you could just suck on it, and you're supposed to take all any sin of alcohol away. I used to keep a dozen of those in every pocket, you know. And I'd see them coming, I'd grab cigars, and chew them. I mean, I'd chew anything. I'd chew horse manure if I thought it'd do any good. And, you know, roll a window down about that much. And back then, you could get away with that. They said, you've been drinking? Drink? Lord, no. I know one time they caught me over there on West Peace Street. They said, where do you live? I said, just down the street. So we're going to follow you home. I said, oh, hell. So I just drove down there and found a good-looking driveway and just put it in there, you know. And got out of the car, waved at them. They drove on off. Fortunately, the folks that lived there didn't report me for being in their yard drunk, you know. I was like that old boy that they caught. State Patrol stopped him. And he was going a little fast, and the state patrol pulled him and said, you look drunk. He said, Lord, no, I'm not drunk. He said, walk that white line out there right beside the road. So he ran up and down it. He ran back. He said, what do you think of that? He said, I still think you're drunk. He said, well, what would you say if I went out and jumped over that fence right there, you know, those fences going on the expressway, and then jumped back over and came back up there? He said, well, I'd like to see that. So he ran down and jumped over this fence. There's a bull sitting on the other side of the fence. And he didn't know that. This bull charges him, and he grabs him, throws that bull to the ground, jumps back over the fence, comes up that state patrol, and says, what do you think of that? He said, I never seen anything like that in my life. He said, how'd you like the way I handled that dude on that motorcycle? So sometimes we just go a little bit too far, you know. You don't want to ever give out too much information. And I decided the thing I needed to do was get married. Boy, what a mistake. I hate that I did this to my first wife. First. Once. I don't know why I mentioned the other two or not. But anyway, I'm a three-time loser, if you don't know. She said I stood in the middle of the Peachtree and said I was going to lay down in front of the trolley car if she didn't marry me. I don't really believe that, but when you're drunk, you know, you get told these things, and women have a way of, you know, putting it to you there, and you don't really know any way to deny it, so. And she said that I said that we ought to get married. And a week later, we were. Well, we started out, and in 3 years, I had a nice little place out there in Brookhaven, a three-bedroom apartment, and in 3 years, I had managed to graduate and move 10 times, each time, of course, a little lower. If you drink liquor and don't work too much, there's something about those combination that seems to have your economic position seems to lower itself somehow or another. Anyway, I mean, to make a long story short, I ended up in an alley off 10th Street behind the Chinese Laundry between Juniper and Peace Street, first class. I mean, this is before the hippies ever thought of this, you know. I mean, the Bohemians weren't in 10th Street then. Had a little garage apartment. Wouldn't live upstairs because I had to live downstairs. At least I had that much class, you know. And so I wasn't working too much. I decided one of my sports around there was I was going to get rid. We was having a rat problem. The little yard I had was right on the side behind this apartment house that faced 10th Street. And it had those great big old garbage cans, 55-gallon jobs. It had a little hill, and these rats were back up in there, and they'd run over and get one of those garbage cans, just take it in the hole with them. And they were big. So I decided I'm going to be the number one rat eradicator, you know, of the 10th Street area. So I got my son. He was about 3 years old at that time. So I got a little chair, a little kitty chair, you know, one of those little kitty chairs about that high that goes with a little dining suit, you know, for the kids. And I got me a big old glass of Jim Beam. I love Jim Beam. Poor man's Jack Daniels. And I had this pistol, automatic pistol, 22 long, shooting at it. I had a barrel about that long. And so I got him a little bucket of water, and he'd run over and pour the water in the hole, and then he'd run back behind me, and then that rat stuck his head out of the ground, I let him have it. So somebody, this was about, you know, in the middle of the day. And so someone says, anybody ever say anything about that? I said, well, let me give you this picture one more time. Here's a drunk sitting in a little kiddie's chair. See? And he's got a glass of liquor in one hand, and he's got a loaded gun in the other. So now you walk up to that guy and ask him what the hell he's doing. I finally got a straight job due to pressure. I am now employed. No, yeah, I'm employed. I don't want to say I work too much. Well, somebody asked me one time, I work out employed by Lockheed. They said, how many folks work out of Lockheed? And I said, about half. He said, what half you in? I said, don't ask, man. Just don't ask. But I got this job because that would be regular. I was working at night. And something about working at night, it gives you all that daytime. And then first thing you knew, I'd start drinking, and then it wasn't important to work at night. And so women are that way, you know, they kind of want you to work regular. You know, and they kind of want you to have a check coming in so they can see it. You know, let me see that. They're funny that way, you know. So I don't blame them for having to live with some of us. I mean, I don't blame them for that. Any rate, I've been out there ever since. But someone asked me one time about retiring. They said, when are you going to retire off the job? You know, outcome. You retired on the damn job. But those three wives I had, and alimony, and the high cost of my low living, I don't know when I'm going to get out of there. But I started that drink. Now, a regular job brings on regular money. And, well, that brought on regular liquor. Not only that, but I started graduating. I moved back into a neighborhood. I mean, I got off on another street up in Morningside. And then I moved to Cobb County so I wouldn't go to the liquor store. See? Now, the liquor store was down at the river, Chattahoochee River, about, 7 miles or so. Well, I'll have you know, I found out I could drive down there on just a half eye, one eye. I mean, I've gone down there many times, just one eye. But when you go down there on half eye, you got it. I never forget one time it snowed. All of about 2 inches. But, I mean, you know, I thought I was snowed in. Actually, the road down to the liquor stores had gotten a great deal of ice with it, and so they'd closed it because it's too dangerous. And I heard about it. It was on Saturday. Man, I ran up to the service station, and they didn't have any change fit in my car. So they had some others, and so I let all the air out of my tires and put these chains on there and then put some more air in my tire, and it just would get on there. And I went slipping and sliding down around those trucks and cars, and I don't know how long it took me to get out of here, and got my supply, and then I didn't care how damn long it snowed. Well, need to say, well, I didn't get halfway back, hardly the sun came out, you know. I bet I drove around those chains on for a week, you know. I couldn't get sober long enough. It was too much trouble to take them off, you know. It was always too much trouble to do anything because it interfered with drinking. I was totally consumed with things it did with drinking. If it didn't have some sort of correlation with drinking, it just really wasn't worth doing. I remember one time I went over to a Tech football game, and I was sitting in the stands there when I was a student in these stands, and I bought one of these old raincoats because it was rainy, and I had my old trusty fifth with me, and I sat down there, and the next thing I know, I'm sitting there, and this old rain thing is just shredded all around me, and the bottle's empty, and a damn soul in these stands but me. I said, where'd everybody go, you know? Those kind of things would happen to me. We had a management club meeting one time in a progressive club. And for some reason or another, I ended up being locked up inside. Everybody else was gone. And this guard says, how did you get in there? I said, not a question how I got in. How do I get out? You know, because I never would go anywhere without, you know, that old side pocket. Because these folks just didn't have enough liquor. One of the things about the people now that, oh, they love it, that old drink. They don't really give a damn about me going to Alcoholics Anonymous, not anything. They just the fact that their liquor supply is safe. They don't have to worry about me coming over. Here's a typical Sunday morning. I went over to this guy's house. He tells me these things. I have to be reminded. If you're like me, you run into these people that said, now, I know you don't remember this, but. And they start telling you. I don't have any problem being reminded I'm an alcoholic because I have too many folks. And they say, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to be just like that damn Speedy Moore. So I went over to his house there one morning, and I'm doing the knocking. I said, E.C., this guy's name. He says, you got any? He said, yeah, I think I got a little bit in a fit. So he brought, you know, drink out. So I drank it. I said, you got anything else? He said, well, I might have a couple of beers around. So I said, well, bring them on, boy. Bring them on. So he brought those out, and we split one. And so I said, you got anything else? He said, yeah, I think I got a little vodka. So we went and got this vodka, and it's about a half pint, so we kill that. Me, mostly. Do you got anything else? He said, I might have some vermouth. So he gets a bottle of vermouth, about 3/4. We drank that damn thing. I said, you got anything else? He says, no. I said, I'll see you. I mean, I'm going to move on. Needless to say, all this period of drinking and so forth, my life became unmanageable. And of course, it always brings me a lot of trouble at home, a lot of trouble financially. That's where it hit me because I used to have to. Money seemed to just kind of go through my fingers somehow or another. And I know one time I came home and my son was sitting in the living room looking at this TV, and which was unusual except, and he says, Daddy, they took it. I said, what do you mean they took it? He says, they took it. And I looked around and all the furniture was gone. Living room. He says, they took it. And I said, no, sorry, no, good. The finance company, well, a finance company, had come along and got my furniture. Of course, I neglected to pay them. That's one reason. But before I could let them get away with that, I had to go make me another loan, you see. And then I got me a cup of fish and came home celebrating being out of debt. You know, those kind of things. When I came into AA, it took me 2 years just to get current. You know, I never have gotten... I don't know what it would be if you got out of debt, but I know what it is to be current, you see. I know the First National sent me one of those letters a couple years ago, more money. And they said, if you fill this out, we'll give you $1,000 line of credit. And I said, those people could not be that stupid. No. And I sent it back to them, and sure enough, here comes this checkbook. And I said, Lord have mercy, boy, sure I'm glad I didn't. What would have happened if they would have sent me that thing when I was drinking? Well, the first place, they never would have sent it. I mean, that's the bottom line is, they never would have sent it. And, of course, I jumped on that. And first thing I knew, they wanted some of that money back. I called this old gal up. I said, why'd you send this to me if you want that money back? They just don't play this thing the way I do. My mother had gotten in a whole lot of trouble. My father was an alcoholic. Every time he drank, he got locked up. Fortunately, he didn't have a car. He was a walking drunk. He'd go downtown and get his hair cut. He had to go down to the old Angela. He was a barber down there. And he just had to have his hair cut by this guy down there. No one else in town would do. Well, if it, by 1 o'clock we didn't hear from him, we just called the city jail. Yeah, then we got him. So I'd go get him. But I would always say to him, I said, boy, I'd never be like that. He was one of these staggering drunks. I mean, he just hit side to side. He never would admit that he had a problem. He always went into a blackout. He never remembered any of it. He eventually had a post-alcoholic convulsion on the way to work one morning. And the net result of that was he lost his conscious memory, the memory of the now. Any blackout takes it away from you, and you're fortunate when you come to. He did not. So that it was wiped out. It's like one of these tapes over here. You tape, and as soon as you tape, you come right around and erase it right off. He could not remember anything in the last 25 years. Eventually had to put him in Millersville, and because he'd go into seizures. So, and eventually he died there, and this is a result from alcohol, arteric heart condition, and pneumonia. Classic illnesses of the alcoholic. Needless to say, I always told them both, I said, you know, if y'all drank right, because they were drinking that wine. And one thing I did not drink was wine, because I associated wine with them bad drunks. Wino. Now, I drink Angostura bitters, anything else. Anything else had alcohol in it, but except wine. And they go buy that Colony wine, $1.25 bottle, and it just anesthetize them. That old ether, that old cheap wine, it'll put you out, put you away, take your mind away from you. So it did. And so my mother, I finally, one day, she was laying up there sucking on this, she had been sucking on this King Cotton. For about 10 days. And if you don't see somebody sick, somebody on King Cotton for 10 days just laying there. In the same dress, the same clothes. Sometimes she went to the bathroom, sometimes she didn't, you know. I just put her in a room and shut the door. Anyway, I told her if she didn't do something about that, damn, I tell her time I go, Callie! Now, I had no idea where it just came like come out of a boat. I believe HP said this. What we got to do with this no good drunk here, we got to work around him. We got to get his mother. And we got to drill this idea in his head that he thought of and get his mother sober. Then we'll work on him. And that's what happened. They came and got her and took her away. They being AA. And I said, well. And first thing you know, they've done. Talking about 13-step or 12-step or something. And then I got a 13-step. 13-step is I want what you have and willing to go to any length to get it. That's what 13-step is. So what they were doing, they were started setting me up. I didn't know this, of course. I was so happy that she was going, and she wasn't laying back there, and I could drink in peace. Not only that, but I could hide my liquor in her room. Now, I didn't know what this was doing to her, of course, but I was hiding it in her room. She'd see me searching all over the house for it. She'd say, "What you looking for, your liquor?" And I said, "Yeah, have you seen it?" She says, "It's under my bed." Because I was hiding it from my wife. Because we was playing one of those hiding games about that time. Because she was busily drinking, too, about this time. She's one of those kind that I don't have about that much, and I'd stashed it, and she'd find it and drink it. You know, it made me so damn mad on Sunday morning. The nerve of this gal drinking my liquor. But anyway, one day she came and says, "Tells me about this place, Nava Club." And she says, "They have this nice meal." And she says, "You might enjoy it, and you can sit down and wait on us while we attend the meeting." And I said, "Well, okay." I was kind of curious to see what was happening to her. Anyway, so I went down there, and we ate, and I sat over in that room, and they said, "Now, you can sit in here while we go to the meeting." And of course, this guy was with them, and he says, he came back to me, he says, "You know, I hate to have you sit in here. I'm going upstairs and see if I can get permission for you to attend this meeting." I said, "Okay." A few minutes later, he comes back down. I said, they said it was all right for you to come to this meeting." I said, "That's a pretty nice bunch of guys." So I go up there, and old Jim P., he's one of them. And he's sitting there, and I remember he said he'd been in 14 institutions. I said, "My God." There's another guy there, Jim. And he'd been locked up some 40-odd times. I said, "Oh, that's been in my daddy to get locked up." And, of course, there was a bunch of others around in that particular first meeting I went to. And I didn't know. They were talking about the first step. And they didn't tell me. I didn't know that they were directing this thing to me. And they said they got around to me. And I said, "I'm an alcoholic. I'm Speedy Moore." And it was just as easy as water rolling off a duck's back. So, and she'd already told me that I couldn't drink and go down there because they didn't like people drinking. I said, "Well, I could give them a day. I could be magnanimous and not drink, you know, until I left there." Well, by the time we left, you know, you sat around and talk and tell all those lies. And, except Bill, he don't tell the lies. And it was about 10 o'clock. Well, by 9 o'clock, I was usually out of it. I'm at 10 o'clock, I've been an hour into my pass out time, because I started at 3:30 as soon as I could get on the parking lot and get in my car and have that first social drink. You know, it's about 180 degrees in the car, the windows rolled up, and I reach under there and get that old bottle of vodka out of there, and it's so damn hot, it's just jumping, you know. You hardly hold on to get the cap off of it, you know. You take a big old slug. God, that was good. And take another and smoke a cigarette. Say, "Boy, this is living, isn't it?" Yeah. I didn't care if I ever got off that parking lot. You can do a lot of drinking between 3:30 and 9 o'clock at night. So that was kind of late, so I put it off. Tomorrow I'm drinking. Well, tomorrow, just so happens she had some folks up at the church in St. Jude's, where I was a member, supposed to be a member. I was a Whiskeypalian. The church, though, was to put me on usher duty. And anytime I came, they always inspected the woodwork and the damn beams and everything else would fall in. The thing I remember the most about this particular minister was that at the end, the recessional hymn, as soon as he got in this little back room, you know, they say this little muted prayer, and that prayer was a serenity prayer. And I knew as soon as he said, "The wisdom to know the difference," I could get up and go home and start looking for that liquor. And that's how I remember the serenity prayer. But at any rate, this meeting I went to, I said, "Okay, I'll go and see who's there." She said, "You know some of them." Yeah, and lo and behold, here's this guy I used to run down the river with. And He said, "What you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I just came to see what's happening around here." And he said, "Well, I'm just here for my wife." So I asked his wife, "Why was she here?" She said, "Well, she was here for him." And I said, "That don't make a whole lot of sense to me, but who knows? I don't know anything. If I knew anything, I wouldn't be here." It always tickles me that folks that come to AA nowadays seem to be so brilliant. I know I was in a meeting the other day, and he was already on the second level anxiety. I said, "What's the first level?" You know, "I'd hate like hell to see the third level." You know, whatever that is. So the boy said, "He was Charles, and he was Polly addicted." I said, "I'm Speedy, and I'm Sarah, Jane, Mary, Ann, I don't know Polly. I'm addicted to all of them." And he eventually shot himself, so he wasn't too damn addicted on it. So some of this new stuff that's coming in on some of these treatment centers kind of blows your mind a little. I know this one guy in this IQ business, he was on the phone. He says, "I was over at one of the meeting places in Atlanta there, and the triangle guy says, Speedy, he says, you got to talk to this guy." He says, "He's blowing my mind." He says, "His name is Charles." So I picked up the phone and says, "Charles, you want this program? You too stupid." He says, "How dare you? How dare you? How dare you talk to me like this?" I said, "Oh, God." He says, "I'll have you know I have an IQ of 158. He says, "What's yours?" I said, 83. He says, "Let me speak with someone smarter than you are." I said, "Charles, I hate to tell you this, but I'm the smartest one here." That guy has never been seen again. You know. So I don't know about this new breed of things coming. I know the guys told me, he says, "Now, if you want to get sober and are serious about it, you stay in here and you might learn something. Right now, you don't know anything. And just remember that you don't know anything. If you knew anything, you wouldn't be here." And he says, "If you don't like what we say," he says, "See that door right over there?" He says, "Don't let it hit you in the ass. Leave it." "Now, we're going to love them into sobriety." "Say, come with me. I'm the way and the light." You know? It's no wonder that we have a lot of folks who go back to drinking, because they don't know what really getting sober is all about. Sometimes I get a little cynical about that, but I have to remember that where I was, and that's another phrase that just means, "I know where you're coming from." I say, "Yeah, you live in Smyrna?" So, you know, I don't know what that has to do with getting sober. You know, I know that they told me, "Here's a simple program, except for you it's going to be difficult, because you're so damn arrogant. You're going to try to find some way to change all this." And when I first looked at it, I said, "Oh, nothing to that." Didn't understand a damn one of them. You know? But I had a good sponsor. He was kind of given to me, and I'm going to shut up, because these meetings don't last long enough. Now, they have too much preamble. Yeah. But this man was my tutor, and we sat down every afternoon, and we studied. And he went over the steps, explained them to me, and we studied them. And I remember he used to make a talk, and when he talked, you could hear a feather drop, and it sounded like a drum beating. I mean, he had a great way with words. He was an artist, and he was an Irishman, and he spoke with his brogue, and folks hung on every word. And I got a call one day that And I went over to see him, and he was drunk. And I couldn't believe this saint of a man was drinking. And he told me, though, before that, he says, you cannot depend on a human being for your support, because humans are fallible. We make mistakes. So you must depend on this power that we've been studying. So I came to know that this power, and I used to use the group, even though I was raised in a Whiskeypedian, as a Whiskeypedian, I knew all the tenets of the church, but I never felt any of them. I feel so when I come in AA meeting, you can feel, if you're like me, I can feel that power. And when we talk about power, that's where it is, intellect, power, in this group right here. So you must depend on higher power, or you cannot stay sober, and you cannot be happy. And to me, if you cannot be happy being sober, I don't know, I believe I'd just soon be drunk. But I think in the big book it talks about joyous, happy, free. So I did find that this, and he says not only that, but when you be careful, because this power, if you get ready to use it and you ask, you're going to get it. So you have to be careful what you pray for, because you could get it. So only use it if you need it. So I feel like it's there, and I can just call on any time that I need. And I do know that power does give you the strength to persevere over anything that there's nothing that can happen to anyone in AA. And I think everything that can happen to someone, I think has happened to me. I'm going to give you one example, then I'll shut up. I'd been AA for 5 years, or six, and my youngest son, I only had two sons, he was 18 years old, he and this little girl had gotten married, and they just had to be married, and so day after Christmas, they were coming down Northside Drive, right when it starts into a four-lane, and a guy coming south, going too fast, hit the guardrail and bounced over and hit them both head on, and they were both killed. Now, when that happened, the power that I'm talking about, the strength, it never occurred to me to take a drink. You see? A guy came up to me in a funeral home, he says, you know what you need, Speed, is a drink. And this guy was bombed. He was so drunk, he had to get bombed out of his mind to come to the funeral. And I felt sorry for him. He's the one who needed help, not me. Because I had all the strength that AA had given me, you see. And it will. I don't care what happens. And so, and it taught me, it caused the pain. It lasts. It's like anything else. But AA, the program itself, teaches you that things do change and things get better. And we get better, and we're able to do more things. We're able to absorb, to take more pain, both emotionally and physical. So the love of AA, then, to me, the power, that's the power. And that's what makes it work. The unselfish giving of one to another, expecting nothing in return. Well, I think that's what does it. I believe it, for me, anyway. And I'll quit. Thank you very much.